Ross Gay is author of two previous collections, Against Which and Bringing the Shovel Down. His poems have appeared in the American Poetry Review, Orion, The Sun, and elsewhere. He is an associate professor of poetry at Indiana University and teaches at Drew University's Low Residency MFA in Poetry. His latest book is Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude. Ross Gay, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Congratulations on your latest book. I had kind of a serendipitous last couple of weeks. The last three poets that I interviewed, you being the last of the group, had this kind of weird connection. The first one was Thomas Lux. His new book, To the Left of Time, just came out, and so I had him on the show. I had no idea there was any relationship between you and Thomas Lux. But the next week, I talked to Keith Leonard. And I knew that you were connected, you two were connected, not only at first through his poetry, but then I saw that he dedicated one of the poems to you and that he thanked you for the figs, which we'll get to later. And then now you. And so from what I understand, Thomas Lux was your teacher and you were Keith Leonard's teacher.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. And it was just, like I said, it was all serendipitous, one, two, three. And
yeah.
But as I was reading all three of the books at the same time, there's a lot of odes going on.
Yeah. Tom was really he's such an important poet to me, Tom Lux. He's kind of my, like, one of my earliest teachers of poetry. So, and just an incredibly generous and loving, such a good teacher. Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, one of his biography asserts that that's part of his identity is really that teaching really matters to him. And so if he is even slightly responsible for you, and if you are even slightly responsible for Keith, then it's a wonderful, wonderful chain of poetry.
And I'm
glad to have been able to check out a few of the links. Maybe we can start off with talking a little bit about your background, where you grew up, and how you got into poetry.
Yeah, I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, but we moved pretty. We sort of followed my dad's work around that, like, northeastern Ohio, and then we moved. When I was a little guy, I grew up mostly right outside of Philadelphia, in Levittown, Pennsylvania, Langhorne, Pennsylvania area.
You're not necessarily a poet of landscape, per se. I mean, I don't see a lot of Philadelphia. I see a lot of your garden, but I don't see a lot of landscape. Do you think that the landscape had any effect on how you became a poet, or what point was it that you decided, I think I want to write poetry?
Well, the whole thing of writing poems was not at all it wasn't in my head as a possibility. Not that, I don't know, I thought I'd probably like have some kind of regular job, because we mostly had regular jobs,
Right.
But I also came from readers. Like, my dad was an avid reader.
Mm-hmm.
So, the idea of, like, reading books was very much in my life, but the idea of writing poems was not as much. But I had a teacher in college I was a football player in college. I went to Lafayette College. I was a football player. I was close to failing out. I had a teacher there who made me give a presentation on the poet Amiri Baraka, which was a really powerful experience for me. He was writing about, race and class, and was articulating things that I did not have language for, particularly alienation, a particular kind of alienation that I think I was feeling. And so then I started reading poems, and then I think I started writing poems too.
And
talking about being a teacher, there was a teacher, a guy named David Johnson, who saw that, he probably spotted that, this kid's going to be out of college in a minute. He kind of is among the people in my life who gave me poetry.
And hadn't you been a poet, what might have you have been?
I don't know. A teacher, teachers run in my family.
Okay.
I am a teacher anyway, but I don't know, maybe I would have been like a social studies teacher or something. Like that. I love teaching. I like being in schools. I like, young folks.
Yeah. Well, you are a university professor at Indiana in Bloomington, right?
Yeah.
I also am a professor in the creative writing department here at the University of Texas in El Paso. And
cool.
And it's the greatest job in the world to have for a writer, isn't it?
Oh my God, it's such a lucky job. I mean, it's such a lucky job.
We could teach what we're reading.
Yeah.
And if we're working on a particular book, we can choose books to teach that are going to help us write our books.
Yeah. It's incredible. It's incredible. Right. And to be constantly working with folks who are really inspirational, I feel like I have incredible students again and again and again and again. And I am, often inspired by my students, by what they do and what they do sometimes without necessarily even knowing that they've done.
Right. Do you ever steal off your students?
Oh, I get ideas off my students all the time.
Oh, so do
all the time. Yeah.
And, I'm thinking about that idea of working in a research institution where we're valued more for, really, quite frankly, what we publish than the service that we do or our evaluations. And you are, and one of the things that we do to live non-fragmented lives, of course, is to try to put all that stuff together so it works in, kind of one momentum. And so the fact is, a lot of us do teach books that we need to read at the time. And I'm wondering if, as you were working on this beautiful book, Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, if you re-entered Walt Whitman, which many, many critics are comparing you to.
A little bit. I think I was probably touching into Walt Whitman a little bit while I was writing this book. But I think I was dabbling a little bit more in Neruda. And Gerald Stern is a poet who, he was one of my teachers. He's sort of, a very important mentor for me and a dear friend. And, the more, if you go back and read, Stern, particularly his long poems, you'll see, you'll see it clearly. So, that's another way of saying, I am in Whitman, but I'm often in Whitman through Stern.
I see, that makes me want to go back to read Stern. Your book, had quite an effect on me. It's a beautiful book. It was described by NPR as like one big celebration bursting with joy.
That's pretty lovely. That's pretty nice.
Is that a fair way to describe it?
It is. I mean, it's also it's entirely elegiac. It's all elegy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of amazing. I love that people are able to witness the joy. I sort of imagine the book as being this adult joy by which, to me, I think of a kind of complicated being able to celebrate, and celebration also sort of acknowledging that our lives are filled, in fact, with pain. That's just what it means to be alive. And so it makes me happy that people are sort of drawn to the joy in the book, while at the same time, I understand, and presumably readers also understand, that they're having this feeling of joy in the midst of a book that's about just difficult things,
You have this beautiful poem by about Don Benton, and I looked him up, but I'm going to go ahead and let you tell who he is.
Yeah.
But it's an incredibly sad poem, but we have this line that suddenly comes out, and to me, this really is a lot of your poetry. Mm. It says, "I would convert this sorrow into some kind of honey with the little musics." Beautiful poem, but it's really sad. And can you tell a little bit about Don Benton and how this particular poem had to happen? I assume it had to happen.
Yeah. Don Belton. He was just a dear friend. He worked at IU for a year and a half. Though we had a little bit of overlap in Philadelphia. We didn't know each other, but when he came to interview for this job at IU, we recognized each other from various events that we've both been at in Philadelphia. But anyway, he was just a really dear friend and amazing person, and he is an amazing writer. He has a novel and many essays, and he edited a collection of essays, and just a very important, beautiful writer and thinker. And he was murdered shortly after he came to Bloomington, and that's sort of what that poem's about. There's no way of getting out of that heartbreak. That's what that poem's about.
There's a lot of pain in these poems. I mean, it's not, there is joy. And again, I think you really are turning sorrow into honey. There's this one poem about, there's one poem called "To My Best Friend's Sister," which is really a beautiful poem. This older young woman making the speaker of the poem strip in front of her as she criticizes her body. And there's a wonderful line where it says, "I can see myself trying to add some gaudy flourish to this memory, to make of it a fantasy, which is why I linger, hoping to miscall the child, me. And I'm wondering if, as you're writing these poems and you do enter the sadder memories and turn the sorrow into honey, if you do at times have to resist the temptation that may arise to make something into a good memory when it's not.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I noticed it in some of the other poems, but I forgot that it exists in that poem too. There is this, you know, like part of the sort of ethical project of the book is to be like everything requires looking at, you know, like everything needs to be looked at, like what is sorrowful and what is hurtful and what is beautiful and delightful and makes us giddy, you know.
Right.
And so the book itself, like I can kind of feel the book or some of the poems like struggling not to default look at what's painful about a situation, or, you know, at least like sort of it's dramatizing that struggle, you know, some of these poems. You know, there's a poem about the mulberry tree where there's a feeling that something terrible is about to happen or has happened to one of the characters in that poem, and the speaker just decides at this point not to go there, because to go there means that we are all going to die terribly. And which is complicated, you know, it's complicated because the last thing that that book means to do is to turn away. That book wants to look at everything that it can look at as a way of saying, you know, let us be grateful. But I also know there's something to it. It's not simple. It is complicated when you don't look at something, you know, it's always complicated.
I'm talking to Ross Gay. Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude is his latest book of poems. And, you know, Ross, I live right here on the border between El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. And Ciudad Juarez, as you know, is one of the most violent cities, or has been one of the most violent cities in the world. It's also where a lot of the women were being murdered and their bodies were being buried up. Outside my office window at the university, I could see the hills of Juarez, these ramshackle huts, you know, with pastel colored. And when the sun sets, it's the most beautiful, beautiful thing you can imagine. Yet at the same time, you don't want to over-sentimentalize it, because it's also, you know, over poverty and really literally over where the women were buried. You know, so I kind of understand that tendency that we have to avoid. Philip Levine, who was said to be a great poetry teacher, used to tell his students or direct his students to avoid using too much poetic language, like the word soul and the word heart and, you know, and love, all those words that mean a lot to Neruda. And I remember I was staying in his home for a semester when I was a visiting writer, and I was in his office, and he has all these poetry books, and I would pull them down, and I pulled one out by Sharon Olds. And it was really cool, as I could read his comments in the margin. And he had circled every time she used the word soul. And about the third or fourth time, he goes, okay, I get it, soul. What I love is how unabashedly, to use your own word, you use the word joy in this book. I counted at least five times. And I'm wondering, as you're using the word joy, was there ever an instinct to say, wait, maybe I'm doing it too much, maybe I should pull back?
I mean, you know, part of it, first of all, I want to say, like, with Levine's poems, like, if we flipped open, like, so many of Levine's poems are so damn poetic.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting the way that we do these things. But anyway, I absolutely wrestled with that. Like, there are these people in my head, I've realized, and I've said this, there are these people in my head, and they, like, they are ironic, and they are, you know, real, quote-unquote, brainy, and they are, like, you know, a little bit mean, and they hang out in my head. And like when I say things like joy or giddy or delight, they sneer at me, you know?
Right.
And I'm totally conscious of that. And also like was like, you know, I'm just going to go on and do that.
And you know, one of the things I love about poetry collections is almost every book I read, there's a word I encounter that I didn't know. One of the words that I encountered in yours that I didn't know is the word supine. And maybe I shouldn't have known it. I should have known it, but I didn't. It means lying face up. Cortázar has this wonderful story called La Noche Boca Arriba. And, you know, the night face up. And I thought that would be a beautiful translation, supine night or something like that. But I'm wondering, are there words that you have recently discovered that just strike you and then somehow they make their way into your poetry?
I mean, in that book, there's a couple other words, you know, because I was like, that book is sort of an artifact of my becoming a gardener and orchardist. And so there's some of those kind of words, like there's the word xylem shows up. And I think there's some other words like that. But yeah, I'll get excited about a word and it'll do a thing. It'll sound good in the mouth and I'll get excited to use it for sure.
I'm talking to Ross Gay, and I read an essay that you wrote online, and you were talking about planting persimmons, and gardening seems to be very important to you, not only the communal garden that you are partially responsible for, I believe, in Bloomington, but also your own garden in your backyard. But you said, I planted persimmons. In the description, you say, one's a bit scrawny and leans over like an old man. And then in another poem, you say the oak trees look like giants, and you have this way, and you even admit doing it, that your anthropomorphic way of seeing trees and plants, and it just permeates all your work. It reminded me of what Vincent van Gogh wrote to his brother Theo. He says, if you want to paint a tree, you need to see the humanity in it. Would you agree with that?
I love that. I mean, I love that idea. I don't know if I think that might be like making the anthro in the middle of the thing, you know? It might suggest that a thing is only real in as much as it is human, or a thing is only valuable or beautiful in as much as it can be human-like or humanish. And I don't buy that, obviously, but I very much love him saying it. I still love him saying it because it's clearly a way that he's saying, I love something and I want to sort of make that love shine through something else.
But it's not a hard, fast rule that, everything has to have humanities. Although I have to admit, the way you describe figs as looking like testicles is really a fantastic image. I grew up in Fresno, California, in a fig orchard. I mean, almost literally in a fig orchard. And,
wow.
And I never thought of that, but it's a perfect description. Figs and fig trees. Your book opens up with this really beautiful poem about a fig tree, to the fig tree on 9th and Christian, and everybody just kind of seems to come together when all these figs are blooming on the tree and they're picking them, and figs seem to come back later on, and even Keith Leonard thanks you in his book, in his acknowledgments. He says, thank you for the figs, Ross Gay. What are figs and fig trees to this book and to you as a poet?
Oh, that's a great question. So first I want to say about that community orchard that I work with, I was one of probably 1,000 or more people involved in the beginnings of this orchard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the board, the original board of the orchard, but that was a handful of people who were doing some of the work, and then there was gads of people doing all of this other work. So we were a huge, joyous nation of people making that orchard, and we still are. Figs are, I mean, I like figs, but I don't think I had a fresh fig until my buddy, one of my best friends, Jason Lau's father, gave me one. And they lived, we all went to school together, we grew up together, and he had this incredible garden at their house, and they grew figs, and he gave me some figs, and that was the first time I had a fresh fig. It was also like one of the real models of gardening in my life. That was the person who, I think, my grandparents were serious gardeners and they were farmers before they moved into town and became gardeners. But I think in my sort of regular and daily life, I think Mr. Lau was the gardener that I knew, and an intense and serious and beautiful gardener. So that's the first time I had a fresh fig. And then I was moving out to Indiana, where I teach, and the Lyles were getting ready to move from where they lived, and I felt like, oh, God, they have all these trees. Like, I want to be able to transplant something of that garden as a way of having some of home with me out in Indiana. And I took cuttings from Mr. Lyles' figs. You know, figs are easy to propagate, really easy to propagate. So I took cuttings from the fig and grew them, and they grow at the community orchard right now. They grow, and there's cuttings of that thing have gone all over Bloomington, other places. And So that's sort of, you know, this sort of symbol. And Mr. Lau, he's not like a talkative guy. Like he would like chat with me. Mrs. Lau would chat with me a lot, but Mr. Lau would not like talk a lot. but he gave me figs. You know, he gave me fresh figs, and he gave me cuttings from his tree. And the cuttings from that tree now make, you know, thousands and thousands of figs elsewhere. You know, people who have no idea who this guy is. And that delights me to no end.
Yeah, that's a beautiful image of, and it kind of appears in that poem that leads this book, of just opening your hands and someone putting figs in it. I mean, how many generations of humanity have experienced that?
Great point, yeah.
And, you know, and I, like I said, I grew up in Fresno, and we were surrounded by fig orchards. But, of course, you know, the development came like it does to many places and got rid of fields and put up apartments and houses. And the other thing about fig trees, not only are they not supposed to be in Indiana, but they're also one of the hardest trees to kill once it gets healthy.
Yeah.
I want to ask you something for personal reasons, because my father, when we were kids, decided he was going to paint our house hot pink. And it really made my mother angry. And you have this line where the speaker of the poem, and I always say the speaker of the poem because I never want to assume that it's the writer, but it says, there's a neighbor who once snarled at me and my house. Why would anyone paint a house that color? What is behind that line?
So often the speaker is me. And like I said, don't worry. And that's because my neighbor said, why would you paint a house? Anyone paint a house that color? It's exactly what she said.
What color?
It's just like a bright green, you know. It's not quite like a pink or a purple or anything, though that's a color I would like to live. I'd like my house to be bright, you know. I live in a house where people do paint their houses really bright colors, which I love. I love it. And I love that your dad did that. I wonder how that works out for them.
Well, it didn't work out. My mom hated it, but we were the only ones for a while on that streets with a hot pink house.
Oh, God, that's amazing.
And it also evokes Sandra Cisneros, who had this house in a historical neighborhood in San Antonio, and she painted it a really bright, bright purple.
And
there were neighbors that signed a petition trying to get her to change the color. And anyway, we're running out of time. I have so many things I would love to ask you about, because the book is incredibly rich, and there's so many things to celebrate about this collection. I even wanted to ask you about your sports magazine that you started with Patrick Rosal, who I know, and Carissa Chen, called Some Call It Balling. But maybe people can Google that and check it out, because we are running out of time. So I was wondering if we could have you read one of your poems from Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude.
Yeah. Do you have one in mind? Or
I love the one about the friend sister and the one about the fig tree, the beginning poem. So whichever the one.
Yeah. It's called To My Best Friend's Big Sister. One never knows, does one, how one comes to be standing most ways to naked in front of one's pal's big sister, who has, simply by telling me to, gotten me to shed all but the scantest slap of fabric and twirl before her like a rotisserie chicken as she observes and offers thoughtful critique of my just pubescent physique, which is not a thing to behold, wet with my damp trunks clinging to my damp crotch. And proportion and grace are words the definition of which I don't yet know, nor did I ask the many-skirted scientist sitting open-legged and now shoeless on my mom's couch. Though it may have been just this morning while chucking papers, I heard through the Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock pulsing my Walkman, a mourning dove struggling, snared in the downspout's mouth. And without lowering the volume or missing a verse, I crinkled the rusted aluminum trap enough that with a little wriggle, it was free. It did not at once wobble to some power line, but sat on my hand and looked at me for at least one verse of It Takes Two, sort of bobbing its head and cooing once or twice before flopping off. But that seems very long ago now, as I pirouette my hairless and shivering warble of acne and pudge, burning a hole in the rug as Big Sis tosses off Greek and Latin words like pectorals and gluteus maximus, standing to show me what she means with her hands on my love handles. And now I can see myself trying to add some gaudy slurs to this memory, to make of it a fantasy, which is why I linger, hoping to misrecall the child me. Make of me someone I wasn't. Make of this experience the beginning of a new life. Gilded doors kicked open, blaring trombones, a full beard, Isaac Hayes singing in the background, and me thundering forth on the wild steed of emergent manhood. But I think this child was not that child, obscuring as he was his breasts by tucking his hands into his armpits, and having never even made love to himself yet, was not really a candidate for much besides the chill of a minor shame that he would forget for 15 years, one of what would prove to be many such shames, stitched together like a quilt with all its just legible patterning, which could be a thing heavy and warm to be buried in, or instead might be held up to the light where we see the threads barely holding, so human and frail, so beautiful and sad and small from this remove.
Wow, Ross, as you're reading, do you know that I can hear your smile? You really are a joy to talk to. And the book, it's a fantastic book. And thank you for sharing your light with us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Thanks for your work. Appreciate it.